Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to our Real World Theology interview series, where we take time to chat with the people who are actively engaging in the worlds of culture, entertainment, and theology. This episode, our inaugural episode, we chat with Elijah Davidson. Elijah has recently published a book entitled How to Talk to Movies, Movie Watching as a Spiritual Exercise. Welcome, Elijah.
Hey, thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, Elijah, a lot of people have heard you on the Real World Theology podcast before, talking about films like La La Land or The Hateful Eight, but a lot of people don't really know what you do. So what do you do?
What do I do? Well, don't bring up La La Land. People wanted to like injure me over my thoughts on La La Land.
Well,
Spotlight was a good one to bring up. I was on Spotlight. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then The Hateful Eight for sure. Those were much more People Still Like Me podcasts than the La La Land podcast. Even though I really enjoyed the La La Land podcast.
I enjoyed the conversation in La La Land, so that's why I'm mentioning it. So.
Yeah, and your wife is like super intelligent, and it was great to talk to you too. So yeah.
I think she's super intelligent, but that, you know, I'm biased. Yeah.
You're biased. I'm not. I have like no skin in this game. So I really do think that. What do I do? That was the question. I co-direct an Institute of Theology and Film at Fuller Theological Seminary, which is located in Pasadena, California, or headquartered, I guess you would say, in Pasadena, California. The institute is called Real Spirituality, and I have been at that for about 8 years now, I guess. That's how long I've been with Real Spirituality. And I do a lot of things for real. We have a screening series that we run on campus. I manage that. I organize and manage that. We have a website, so I write a lot. I also edit a lot of other people's writing. We have a podcast that we do with students, with our students. We have a good number of film-interested theology students at Fuller. The podcast is kind of programmed by them, and I help them with that. I'm basically the one who's most responsible for moving the institute forward all the time and making sure we're still doing things. I work with a great team of people, Rob Johnson and Cutter Calloway, Eugene Swin. They're delightful and wonderful to work with. I'm super lucky, but my particular job is just to manage things and make sure they're still going. So,
and for 8 years now, if you've been doing this for 8 years, I'm kind of curious what turned you on to this whole idea that films could be vehicles for theology or theme or conversations in the first place.
I've thought that for a very long time, way longer than I was part of Fuller. I've always looked at as long as I can remember, I've looked at popular culture as expressing the kind of hopes and fears and desires and everything of people and of culture at large. If you got something anything that's expressing those kind of things is going to be ripe for, you know, theological engagement or spiritual engagement, to be a little more vague about it, and a little less precise about theology, because it's not always necessarily theology that's going on. It's often spiritual engagement.
I really like that you're just kind of including all of pop culture in that, because
I know
why we're here typically, and we're going to mostly focus on entertainment. We're going to focus on TV, movies, or cinema, but I do think it is worth saying that all of pop culture is something that we can learn from if we want to engage with it.
So I was watching Beyonce's Lemonade visual album yesterday, and I've been listening to her Lemonade album a lot recently, whatever. And there's, I mean, of course, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
It's why I need someone to start like another podcast on our network, just doing music and theology, because I don't, it's always one of these things. It's kind of like when I got into film and theology, I'm not sure if there was a rising tide of cultural examination that I wrote in on, and you know, it's been going up, or it's always been there and I just found out about it. I just feel like recently, similarly, I feel like more music has more spiritual undertones than I've ever noticed before. And like I said, I'm not sure if I'm just being awoken to that or it's always been this way.
Yeah, I think it's always been that way. And I think it just, you know, as anyone becomes more accustomed to noticing those kind of things in one artistic medium, you're going to start learn how to see them and or hear them in other ones too. Mm. Yeah.
Well, so since our medium again is typically cinema,
like it's film.
It's film, TV. What was the first film you ever remember seeing? Or maybe even a better question would be, what was the first one you remember that kind of stuck with you?
Yeah, we're talking about my book, I guess. So I can refer to that. I mean, the earliest movie memory I have is Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I write about that some in the book. I write about Raiders of the Lost Ark a lot in the book, actually.
It's a great movie, so.
It's a great movie, and it's a good movie for kind of teaching the fundamentals of what a movie is. So, I was a little kid. I don't know how old I was. I was super little, though, way too small to be little to be watching Raiders of the Lost Ark. And my parents were letting me watch it with them. And, you know, like, spoiler alert here, at the end of the movie, when the ark is opened and the Nazis' faces melt because of the angels, that scared the living daylights out of me. I look back at that now, and I kind of see that as kind of what put me on this course of trying to figure out how movies do that. To you, and why it affected me like that, and all that kind of stuff. Definitely the early one.
So, if that was the earliest one you saw, what are some other films kind of along your cinematic journey that you really just love, or that have kind of also spurred this on?
Yeah. When I was younger in like junior high and stuff, I would watch Mission Impossible, the first one, the Brian De Palma directed one, on repeat all the time. I watched Apollo 13 incessantly at the same time. And I still watch Apollo 13 kind of incessantly, actually. I love that movie. So those were big. The Bourne Identity was pretty huge for me. When it came out, I watched that one a lot. Wall-E has been one in more recent years that's been really important. As I've learned more about like how to interact with movies, in this kind of, a spiritual exercise, it's kind of a spiritual way or whatever. It can be real surprising sometimes what movies, have kind of deep impacts on me, when I started watching them that way. So, really odd movies sometimes that have pretty profound impacts. So,
have you done any like self-evaluating and kind of, you know, you're mentioning like what on the surface appears to be
why those movies?
Yeah, a wide swath. It's like, do you notice like a theme that you continually come back to, or like a theological wrestling that you come back to in film, or just a genre that you really like and that's connecting with you for reasons that, you know, you need to go to, is it a psychiatrist or a therapist to work out?
Right. Yeah. If you look at movies like The Bourne Identity and Mission Impossible and Wall-E, a central like concern in those films is identity. Mm-hmm. Like who someone is, like who they are at their core, and what they are made for. That's a really important question to me, just personally. Like, it's always kind of driven me to like figure out who am I and why am I here kind of thing. But in a unique kind of way, like why am I uniquely me? And why am I uniquely here? Like, what does God have for me? Or why, if anything, and what would God have me do or not do or whatever? Those kind of questions have always been pretty core to who I am. And that's in a lot of those movies. The Apollo 13, the thing that I've learned that I really love about Apollo 13 is, I like the mission control guys side of the movie, as much as the astronaut side of the movie, because I just love to watch a big group of people, and this is a kind of a unique identity thing, but like bring their unique skills to a project and accomplish something together that they could have never accomplished on their own. So The Great Escape is another one that I've watched tons of times growing up, and it's that same thing. It's like, have you seen The Great Escape
before? I have.
Yes.
It's depressing.
Depressing? Oh man, I love that movie so much. It is sad. Some of them do die. But not all of them.
Basically everyone but Steve McQueen, spoiler alert.
Well, not other people live too. Have you ever heard
Eddie Izzard do his kind of stand up thing about The Great Escape?
No.
And watching he does this very I think hilarious kind of bit about how, you know, he's growing up British but really admiring film. Uh-huh. And he said that, you know, basically British people are always the bad guys. Like one movie that he really enjoyed was The Great Escape. And he basically goes through and talks about how it makes him, The Great Escape makes most British people would basically want to be American, because the whole movie is a whole bunch of British people like planning and scheming and creating all this stuff. Meanwhile, Steve McQueen's just walking around being cool. And then like it comes time for the escape, and all these British people who have planned and schemed or whatever, they end up getting shot. Steve McQueen, cool, riding a motorbike, you know, doing his thing.
Being cool.
You know, he's like, what kind of message is this sending to British kids? Oh, it's just... Anyway, every time I see the Great Escape, that's what I think about, and I think it's probably...
That's funny. That's true, though. about the movie, I suppose. But what I love about it, like, same with the Apollo 13 thing, like, all these people that have unique skills and gifts, you know, and they know what those things are. Like they know what their gifts and their skills are, and they work together doing their own little thing to do something pretty amazing that they could have never done on their own. So like that idea, that core identity thing that makes you unique is a thing that's really important to me. And like a driving question in my life. At one point in the book, you know, there's a part of the book where I talk about character types. And I used the Enneagram, Richard Rohr's work on the Enneagram to but I apply it to fictional characters, which I actually think it's more useful for fictional characters than it is for real people.
Because it's so broad?
Because the Enneagram is so broad, you mean?
Because the Enneagram seems like it could be a little vague. Maybe vague is the word.
It is kind of vague, but mainly because people, like real people, are way more complicated than any personality inventory. And that's essentially what the Enneagram is a kind of personality inventory. My undergraduate degree was largely focused on different personality inventories. So I studied all those things. And I really love Richard Rohr's Enneagram work, by the way. People should check that out. His book is Enneagram, A Christian Perspective. It's really great. It's a little negative. It kind of hones in on the like ways you are broken side of things, but it's also the most specific and helpful of all those Enneagram books that I've read.
So as an aside, seeing as how you spent so much time in that, is there one personality test that you tend to lean towards when people want to do those personality inventories?
No, I mean, it depends on what they're looking to do. Because they all have different strengths, which is another personality inventory. But they all have different values. So if you're looking to like do group work, I'd recommend a different one than if you want to do like spiritual development, or if you want to do like career placement. They're all different. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
I think I did sidetrack you though.
You did a little bit there. But I was like, so, you know, take what Rohr's work with the Enneagram, but then I use it to like get at like core character motivations. and how to understand core character motivations. I think works really well because movie characters, if they're written well, are pretty well defined. And it can really help you like get to the heart of what the movie cares about, and help you kind of really hear what the movie is saying better. And it solves a lot of problems that people have with movies that feature really like detestable people, because you learn to see like, okay, well, they are detestable, but they are on a journey to become something different. Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful for that. And a lot of those movies that I just talked about, not Apollo 13 or The Great Escape so much, but the other ones would fit as a four type of character. They're truth seekers, characters who are looking for like some core, like hard truth about who they are or about the universe or whatever, only about who they are and how they fit into things. So I tend to gravitate towards four movies, I believe.
Mm. So you've written this book, How to Talk to Movies. And so besides the financial windfall that you're obviously experiencing right now, why did you feel the need to write this book? I mean, like, you already kind of have this stuff down. You're working for an institution that does this. Like, you have a job. You don't have to prove to someone that you need to do this. Like, why did you write it? Who is this written for?
Yeah. I wrote it for a few reasons. The first reason I wrote it was just because I had kind of accidentally outlined it, and just it was sitting there in a document, and I was like, oh, that's a book. I could write that. And so I did. That was really the number one, like the first reason. And I say that because if anyone listening and like wants to write a book, like just write a book, like just like for no other reason than the fact that you have a thing you want to write, just write it. That was big for me, as a writer, just to do the thing. The second thing was that, I was having a lot of conversation with my brother, who was 19 years old at the time, on the phone. He was in college, freshman in college, about movies. And, you know, I mean, I've studied film theory and all this like and theological stuff and all this whatever. So like, for me, like a lot of the conversations we were having, I was like, you know, like Micah, like you're smart and you see things here, but you don't have the language to talk about them, you know? Like you don't know how to talk about editing or cinematography or sound design, you know, but you are experiencing these things. You just don't realize it. Movies do that well, like kind of do their thing in a way that comes pretty intuitive to people. And you just need like some language to talk about it. I always thought like with my brother, if I had like 2 hours to sit down with him and like watch a movie, I could like show him what all these things are that he's already talking about, but not knowing he's talking about it. And then our conversations would be like so much more, so could go so deeper, quicker, because we'd speak in the same language or whatever. So I kind of wrote it for him in a way, or people like him that, you know, just write so close if you just had a little time with him. And then the other reason I wrote it was because, I mean, as part of my studies and whatnot, I've read a lot of books on theology and film. And I would say that there's like two kinds of Christian film. Well, there's three kinds of Christian film books, but I don't want to talk about one of them really. But because the one of them is like movies are bad and they're going to kill you and like take you to hell and stuff. And they're very fearful movies, fearful books about movies. And I just don't think those are useful at all. So I don't really count those. But the other two kinds, there's like high academic theology, theology and film books that really like no one's going to read. I mean, some people read them. I've read them.
If you sign up for a class and your professor tells you to buy the book, that's when you're reading it.
Then you read them. Right. But like nobody else can read those. You have to like learn how to read those things, and learn how to have value in those things. They're great. Some great stuff out there. But it's all high academia. And then there are a lot of books, that are more, they're popular level, like written for anyone to read, but they're more reflective, or memoir-like, where people are talking about the importance of movies in their life. And there's a lot of like, those books end up being like, almost like, hey, I'm in this wonderful country, And I live here and it's great and you should come here too. But but there's like a gap between like, okay, but there's an ocean. Like, how do I get there? You know? And I love those books. They're very, very, at the time of my life, they were very encouraging. They spurred me on to learn more, you know, but I had to do that in other ways. Like, they didn't do that for me, you know? So between the academic books and these more reflective books, there just wasn't anything that was direct and practical and, just kind of opened the door for people into this world of watching movies this way.
So you're talking about direct and practical, and this is a short book. It's got less than 100 pages. What's the benefit of publishing such a short book when there's obviously so much to say? There's like so many vocabulary terms. Do you think that you can get enough through in less than 100 pages? I'm asking this kind of as like a devil's advocate, because I've obviously read it and I think it's great. But what would your pitch? What would your pitch to someone be?
Like, about why that one?
Yeah, they're like, well, why don't I read this academic book that's obviously like this, or.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, honestly, like, so I hope I did that. I mean, I hope there's value in it. I mean, you liked it, so you think there is. I hope there is. I just think that honestly, movies aren't that complicated. Mm. They do a lot of complicated things, but the basic fundamentals of what a movie is or what a TV show is just it's not really that complicated. You know, there's a camera. And they film actors doing things in an environment that someone created most of the time. And then those things are edited together in a way that gives meaning to what's going on, a different kind of meaning, than if you just like didn't have any edits in it. And all of that is overlaid with music, and other sound effects, but mainly music. That's pretty much all a movie is, you know? But we don't always I don't think we always realize that movies are kind of built to work without you thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know? But once you start noticing it, you can see a lot of, you end up seeing a lot more meaning there than if you're just sitting there just kind of being entertained by it. So I think there is value in something short like this that just kind of gets to the point quickly. So once you start realizing how movies work, and how they're, I would say, saying what they're saying, it becomes easier to do it. And it's not hard to figure that kind of stuff out it's really not. And so I wanted to write something that was quick to read, that you could hopefully sit down and read in 2 hours, you know? And really kind of change the way that you watch movies. In lieu of being able to sit in a room with every person who reads this book and watch a movie with them, and kind of show them how editing works and stuff. I think this is the next best thing I could do to do that. And I did. I wanted it to be short for two reasons. I mean, I wanted it to be not intimidating to look at. I wanted it to be something people go, oh yeah, check that out. I also wanted it to be cheap. So many of those longer books, the academic books and whatnot, are very expensive. I didn't want money to be a barrier to anyone picking it up either. Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, I think that's great. I love the fact that you're pointing out something that I don't think people really talk about, which is the fact that movies, I mean, fundamentally are simple. There's only typically a couple moving parts, you know. Maybe it's like Mexican food. It's like the same six ingredients. Now you can mix them and match them all different kinds of ways. But if you understand these six ingredients or however many there are to a movie, then barring the couple fringe filmmakers, you're understanding most of what's going on. And then what I think it does, which is I think incredible, and one of the reasons I love the book so much, is I found it gave words and phrasing to many of the things that I try to tell people when they ask specifically what we do at Real World Theology, or what I do with, podcasting or hosting the site, or anytime I have a live event. There is vocabulary in this book that I think anyone can easily grasp. You explain things very well. Most like you mentioned a little while ago, having that vocabulary is in any context, in any conversation, when you're speaking the same language, everything mm-hmm. else is a little bit easier.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really kind of the core idea of the book, is like learning to speak the same language. Mm-hmm. First as the movie speaks, like listen to the movie first, you know?
Yeah.
And then with each other. Yeah. That's kind of the extension of it. I actually think it's kind of funny, like talking to you and to your listeners about the book, because my hunch is that most people who listen to your podcast don't need this book, that they already understand most of this stuff. But what I also kind of think is that, but there's probably people in their life that don't understand why they would listen to a podcast like this, or why movies would mean something to them, who would benefit greatly from the book, you mm-hmm. know, it would just kind of, yeah.
Well, I was gonna say, I appreciate you thinking the best of even myself and the listeners of the show. But like I said, I'm reading this book and I'm seeing ways to phrase things that are, I think, better than I have phrased them, having done this for years. And even if there are people, I mean, our listeners are pretty smart. They're pretty apt. Most of them have followed along with us for quite some time, or they followed other people, other sites, other podcasts that do pretty similar things. They're probably listened to Real Spirituality. They probably been over to the, you know, the Brem Center page and read some of your reviews. So it's not that they don't know that this is important.
Yeah.
But I can tell from the discussions that we have on our Facebook discussion group, or through Facebook messages or emails that we get to the site, that people still aren't, we're not speaking the same language. We're all trying to say the same thing, but we're not speaking the same language. And I think it, like I said, it's still beneficial, even if you realize that film and like the talking to a movie is important. Maybe that first chapter where you're like, hey, this is why it's important. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. But then like understanding, like I said, the terminology behind it, it's just invaluable. It would make a lot of the discussions we have like a lot more streamlined. Yeah. So
that's good to hear.
So I mean, like, you know, I realize kind of what you're saying, and you know, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt, but I think there is value in it, even if you already agree with everything Elijah's, or, you know, everything you're saying. Well, I know you said you didn't really want to talk about like that antagonistic view of cinema.
But we need to a little bit, right?
Well, but I feel like one of the questions or one of the pushbacks we would get is kind of like at least how we've propositioned it so far, not having read the book. I can see someone saying, well, you're saying talk to movies, but maybe some things, they're movies that I don't want to talk to. And in the book, you note that Christians have been talking about cinema for as long as there has been cinema, but most writing from Christians has been concerned with what other Christians should or shouldn't watch. The history of Christians in movies is a history of attacks or defenses on certain films or filmmakers. So, yeah. I'm kind of curious why you think that is the case, and what kind of pitch could you make for there being benefit of, because I know you do this in the book, but the 30,000 foot view of it, what's the benefit of talking to a movie that we disagree with?
Yeah. So first, why do I think that it has been that way?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In my wise opinion of history, this is not researched. What I will say to answer the first part of that question, I haven't researched this thing as much as I'd like, but my hunch would be that movies are powerful things, and they're very persuasive things. They are powerful, and they persuade because they do better than just about anything at kind of getting at our core hopes and fears and all that kind of stuff we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. you know? And, my guess is that a lot of Christians, early on and through the years have felt a bit threatened by that power that film has. And it's not just movies, though. I mean, there were Christians who were anti, like, painting, you know, mm-hmm. like paintings, and anti all kinds of music and anti drama. I mean, this is an old thing. Art itself is powerful and communicates things better often than what you can get in a sermon. I mean, Jesus did performance art stuff, basically, and the Pharisees freaked out, you know, and tried to discredit him and attack him and all that kind of stuff. So it's any time that the established powers that be tend to react negatively towards anything that threatens their influence. And that has been true of movies too, I think. And it's even been a, and then with movies, you know, you got all the moral, or the immoral acts right there on the screen, like undeniably, you know? And so it becomes very easy to attack those specific things. Yeah, that's kind of my idea about why it's always been that way. Mm-hmm. People are afraid. People are attacking when they're afraid.
Well, and I think when you frame it that way, it actually points out that it's not just Christians do this. Like anyone who is in power, anyone who is afraid, which I think hopefully leads right into what's the benefit of talking to a movie we disagree with.
Yeah. So this was probably the last section I added to the book, because for a long time I just kind of wanted to avoid it. But some people I had to read the book early on were like, no, you need to address this, Elijah. And you need to address it because they told me this because they knew me and they knew the journey I'd been on with movies. So even though my parents were not strict about what we could and couldn't watch, I put a very strict ethic on myself growing up about what I would and wouldn't watch in movies. And until I started working for Real Spirituality, I would not watch any explicit sex or nudity in films. I would literally leave the room. But I would still watch movies. That was the other deal, right? Yeah. Like I would still watch Taxi Driver and Babel and whatever. But I got really good at like figuring out when those scenes were going to happen that I didn't want to see. So I could go online and I would read like the parent advisories or whatever about movies. And, I would know like probably better than most people, like exactly what the scene was I didn't want to see. And I got really good at understanding like when it was going to come up, like forecasting it when I was watching the movie. And then I would like close my eyes or leave the room, sometimes or whatever. So, cause I still wanted to hear what was going on. I just didn't want to see it, you know? I had a really strict ethic about what I wouldn't watch. It was at Fuller. My first class at Fuller was theology and film. And now my fellow co-director, boss, mentor, Rob Johnson taught the class. And, I talked to him that day. He didn't know me at the time. I didn't know him. I was like, I don't really watch sex and nudity. He was like, well, in this class, you're kind of going to have to. And, my wife's coming in again. Oh, water. Thank you. Lovely. Wives are good.
Wives are great.
Yeah. That's very nice of her. I told him I didn't want sex in our nudity movies. Like, well, in this class, you're kind of going to have to.
Can you just start that whole thought over?
Yeah.
Because it'd be easier than editing it into two parts.
Sure. Pause. Yeah. So when I started at Fuller, the first class I took was theology and film, and because I love movies and I couldn't wait to do that, you know. my professor, who is now my boss and my coworker and my mentor, Rob Johnson. I went up to him after the first day of class and I was like, "Hey, you look at your syllabus. What movies you got here? Like, I don't really watch sex and nudity in movies." And he said, "Well, you know, like that's totally up to you." But I would encourage you to not do that for this class, but you know, I'm not going to make you, it's totally up to you what you do. And so I actually went through most of that class, avoiding the sex and the nudity in the movies. And then doing my way of knowing what was going to happen and just not watching it. And then a couple years later, when I started working for Real Spirituality, they hired me on because I was writing about movies already and knew how to run a website and plan events. I had this, like, I was walking around praying and I was like, okay, God, like, you gave me this job. I kind of can't avoid this stuff anymore. In honor of the people who are going to be reading this stuff that I'm writing for or whatever, I probably need to actually watch what's going on. And I lessened my ethic at that point a little bit, I would say. I learned to understand movies better. And I learned how to sit with a movie and like watch it and listen to it, but not like accept everything that it said. Not like have to buy into everything, like to watch it critically, and to think about what was going on and then to respond to it and be like, okay, that was good, but that was not good. And kind of have that discussion with the movie. The other thing that happened, during seminary was that I took ethics, like actually Christian ethics class. And I learned about hospitality, the Christian ethic of hospitality, and as it's like expressed throughout the Bible. And I was just absolutely overwhelmed and taken by this idea of Christian hospitality and what it was Old Testament, New Testament, and then in Christian history since then, and how that has been a real defining factor of what Christians have always been, is a remarkably hospitable people. And hospitality in the biblical sense is not just like having your friends over and like having good food for them. Like hospitality in the biblical sense is inviting in strangers, people who aren't like you, people who in the Old Testament times, who are potentially a threat to you, but still inviting them in anyway and taking care of them and loving them in that moment, you know? And it doesn't mean that you have to like worship their God. It doesn't mean that in the Old Testament sense of things, it doesn't mean that you have to bow to Caesar in the New Testament sense of things, or, you know, anybody else throughout Christian history. But it does mean that you love them and you welcome them in to your home and you respect them that way. So when I learned that was a defining Christian characteristic throughout history, I started trying to apply that to all parts of my life, and that included watching movies. Movies are the work of individuals who bring their unique talents and gifts all together to do this thing, to make this thing that none of them can make by themselves, you know? To go back to mention Paul 13 and The Great Escape again. I love that about movies. But these are people, real people, that have hopes and dreams and fears and questions about life and beliefs about life and all kinds of stuff, you know? And so the story that they're telling, it carries those things. It's an avatar of those things. And so when you welcome a movie into your life for a couple of hours or whatever, you're welcoming in those people, and their hopes and their fears and their dreams and whatnot. And, as before, you don't have to accept it all. But I don't think there's any reason why you shouldn't, be hospitable toward them in that moment. And this long history of Christians and film has been a very inhospitable history of boycotts and content police and all kinds of stuff like that. That's not loving. It's fearful and it's not hospitable. And I really don't believe it's what we should do as Christians. I'm not saying that anybody has to watch things they don't want to watch.
Yeah.
I would never ever say that. I had a very strict ethic on myself, and I respect people who have reasons for not watching certain things. That's totally up to the individual and their community and all that kind of stuff. But in respecting that, I also think that there's another way.
No, you know? So I think that's great because, I mean, it is framing how we engage things or how we talk to a movie that, and like I said, you go into so much more in the book, and I don't want to spoil those things, but just the ideas that just because a movie does or depicts or displays something that we, especially as Christians, don't agree with, does not mean that there's nothing there.
Absolutely.
You gave some really good examples. Like I said, I don't want to spoil them here, but like there are some really great examples specifically of a lot of the things that you're talking about, especially within hospitality and engaging things that, you know, Christians would, on the surface, you would see a boycott for, or you would see, you know, someone being like, oh, well, this is obviously reprehensible. And that, again, I love the fact too that you're framing it in the idea that you're not telling people that it's dumb to kind of be considerate about what they do consume. Because that's important.
It's smart to be considerate about what you watch and don't watch. Absolutely. I think people should be more considerate than they generally are, and more aware of how that movie is working, you know, what it's saying. Absolutely.
Well, and that's the whole concept of listening, I think, that you're going over in the first place. So one of the last things that I wanted to ask you specifically about the book was that I really enjoyed the section titled Talking to a Movie Prepares You to Talk to Other People About Things That Matter. And on one hand, we're having this conversation about how it does us good personally to understand what we're consuming. But how do we make that leap to then it helps us engage with others?
I realize that when I respond to every question you ask, I start by saying, and I think that's because you are setting me up with things that I've written down in a book. So it's like you're giving my ideas back to me. And then I'm like, yeah, it's a good idea.
That's an amazing idea.
That is right. Someone should write that down. That's just a little aside there. That's kind of funny.
Well, because if someone wants to write a book, they should write a book.
That's exactly right. Anyway. But maybe I didn't intend this, but that's a good lead in actually. talking to other people, your question about talking to other people, and listening first. This is what you've done in preparing for this podcast. Like it's, you've already done this thing. Like you read my book. And so you've already listened and like been open to the things that I was thinking about, and the things that I cared about. And now you're having a conversation with me about those things, right?
I hope so.
Yes, you are. It's what it seems like anyway.
Affirmation.
That's what's going on. But it's kind of the same thing with how movies prepare us to talk to other people. So movies, you know, they have effects on people. They do. Sometimes it's funny, strange movies that have effects on people, you know, like Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible movie is not like a paragon of theological work, you know, but it has an effect on me, you know, and as I thought about why, I understood more about myself and about whatever. Movies have effects on people. And if you are in tune to what the movie's saying and how it's saying it, when you have those conversations with people about movies, you are better able to understand like why that movie might have affected them the way that it did. I talk a couple of examples in the book there, but I'll mention one because it still cracks me up every time I think about it. I was having a conversation with a friend here about Space Jam. Space Jam, like
the theological heavyweight film.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know how like on the list of like spiritually important films, it's like Ahazad, Balthazar, and like Tree of Life, and then Space Jam, like on everybody's list, you know.
It's a natural
thing. And we were talking about Space Jam and how much we both liked it, especially when we were kids and whatnot, and how we probably shouldn't watch it again now because we would realize it's probably not very good. but we have like these reasons for loving it, and And then the more we talk, the more we realize that, like, Space Jam deals with the idea of calling, and what people, or, you know, Looney Tunes, are made to be. Like, that's the core question in the movie. It's like, you got Michael Jordan, who gives up basketball to play baseball, and he's not a baseball player, and but he's trying, but through going into outer space and playing basketball with Bugs Bunny, he remembers who he is, you know? Remember who he was made to be and who he's called to be. And at the same time, you got the Looney Tunes going through a similar thing, where they, you know, for most of the movie, they're trying to be basketball players, and they're not basketball players. And, you know, they have this moment where they realize, wait, maybe if we act like Looney Tunes, we'll do okay. And they do, you know, like, they remember who they're made to be, who they're drawn to be. And it's just, yeah. So, like, we ended up having this really intense is wrong, but this really, like, meaningful, deep conversation about calling and, like, what we were called to. And it was all because we both understood how movies worked, because what we were initially talking about was just Space Jam.
Yeah.
And, like, what was, you know? And it, yeah, so it, and so we were open to all those kind of things in that moment.
Well, it's incredible, yeah, because you would never, probably normally never walk right up to him and say, are you insecure about your own personal calling on your life?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I would definitely not do that. And he would not do that to me either.
Yeah.
Yeah. But movies became the safe, the Space Jam became the safe little area of talking about those kind of things. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think I used to think it was, well, I think it was one of the first questions that people ever asked in, when you're introducing to someone, is kind of like, what do you do? What's your job? So I can understand who you are. But if that question comes or doesn't come, almost the next thing in conversation I've noticed today is, have you seen blank? And that blank is always like the latest episode of The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, or do you watch this TV show, or, you know, did you go see this movie lately? Like, they are such great common ground places to start with people. And not that you have to have, like, the most amazing conversation. You know, you don't have to talk to every single person that you talk to about calling or justice or, you know, legalism, you know, but it does give you such a great common area, to talk about more than just being entertained.
Just last night, someone asked me if I had seen Ghost in the Shell yet. And we started talking about Ghost in the Shell and about, well, what the new movie doesn't do very well, but what the old anime film does. And, you know, that's a conversation about, like, gosh, it's a conversation about, like, human souls and the way that technology obscures, you know, anything that's distinct about us, and what this world is where we're having a conversation via computer and not in person, like, and how our, like, and then someone else listens to this also, like, through their phone or whatever, while they're walking around somewhere, and, like, this disembodied reality thing, you know, like, because of a bad Ghost in the Shell movie.
That's where
conversations go with movies. Movies are about everything.
Yeah. Know? And thus, yeah, Ghost in the Shell, even though, you know, you had issues with it, it still helped you prepare to talk to another person about something that mattered.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Well, so
this friend, I'm not going to say his name, and he won't hear this probably. So,
well, it's unfortunate for them.
Well, yeah, it is. He's a great guy. His daughter was recently diagnosed with diabetes, like type 1 diabetes. And she's like a little bitty tiny girl. And they've done, like, there's, like, implants they can do now to help, like, monitor insulin or whatever, like bodily implants or whatever. And they joke about her being, like, her journey towards being part cyborg. But that's the same thing Ghost in the Shell's about. Like, that's kind of the idea, you know? So of course we talked about that last night because that's what's on his mind. And I did not connect that until right now.
Huh. Yeah. Well, I mean, it reminds me of a really great, seminar that I heard when I was at Cornerstone Festival in Illinois a couple years back, or it had to be probably more than a couple years back now, since it's not been around for a while. But there was someone trying to get people to think about, like, what makes us who we are. And he basically had everyone raise their hands and said, okay, I want you to keep your hand raised as long as you feel like something could pass as a human. And then he basically went through the list and started, you have a prosthetic leg, you know, you have two prosthetic legs, like you have an artificial heart, you know, and just kind of kept going mm-hmm. and going. And you could see the hands start to go down as people kind of were wrestling with, like, what, mm-hmm. like, where is that line? Like, what does it take? You know, and he obviously went into this really great thing and talked about the soul and what makes us human. But mm-hmm. It was just this thing, you know, people aren't thinking about. And and you typically never have that conversation directly. He was using a different medium, but Ghost in the Shell, man. Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, if I had been just a little more aware last night, I would have realized that my friend was thinking about and worried about his daughter.
Yeah.
And what she's going to go through as she grows up and what other technologies are going to be available as she gets older to make it easier on her, but how that will affect her humanity and whatnot. I just, movies, man.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, we're sitting here being in awe of the power that story has, you know, and the power that cinema has. So the last thing I want to ask you is just, and it's not a book setup question, so you don't have to agree with this one. What would you suggest as some of the best movies for people who want to, using a metaphor from the book, accept the invitation to the party?
No. I said yeah when it's my own stuff, so I say no when it's not. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. So you're asking, like, what movies people could maybe seek out if they want to, like, join the party kind of thing?
Yeah, and we're using the join the party. The metaphor in the book was you're hoping the book is kind of like an invitation to the party, but if people really want to start watching some films and using your book as kind of like a guide to how to talk to movies, what films would really be helpful?
I'm going to dodge your question and not give you any direct movies. But I would say that, I would say it depends on the person. If there is a movie that you love, that you've watched again and again and again, that you just can't get enough of, or if there are a handful of movies like that, I would say, take the kind of the thing that I explained, hopefully very directly and easy to understand in the book. And apply that to that movie that you're watching and those movies that you love already, that you know well, and see what you don't, if you don't discover something about what drives you and then ask so the last bit of the book there is about, like, taking that and saying, okay, so what might God be saying to me? What might the Holy Spirit be trying to quicken in me? Through these kind of film experiences, and ask those questions. We could do that with you right now if we wanted to. You want to do that right now?
Well, I do this all the time. I do this, like,
yeah. So what movies do you love?
Well, so when I think about things like this, I think at one point in my life, I was doing this to film and not realizing basically exactly what you're saying. I was watching a movie over and over and over, and I never knew why. I just wanted to watch the film over and over and over and over again. And then using, again, things that I wouldn't use the same vocabulary as the book used historically, but mm-hmm. asking some very similar questions based on things that I'd seen other people ask, the ways that seemed I could get people to start conversations in film screenings, like when we get together as as groups of people to watch a film. And I realized today some of the films that I think have probably resulted in some of the most profound answers are still films that I've enjoyed for a long time, which you know, my teenage years produced films like Gladiator. Well, my late teenage years, Gladiator, the all the things going on in that film, films like Saving Private Ryan, that I'd watched a lot, like again as a teenager. Also, maybe surprisingly, but it also helped me kind of work through things in like The Princess Bride and Robin Hood Men in Tights. Because you would probably never think about it, but lots of the things that actually happened that I enjoyed Robin Hood Men in Tights for were actually more meta. It wasn't actually what was happening in the story, but it was the kind of the way that the story was being told that I connected with. It showed me a lot about how I enjoyed dealing with the world, my own personal brand of humor, things that I found funny, things that I would use to diffuse situations. I found a lot of that in a movie with the comedy stylings of Mel Brooks or Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like I said, asking very similar questions. Today, it happens a lot when one of the first movies I ask people if they've seen, especially if they're Christian, I was like, have you seen Calvary?
Yeah.
Because I feel like that makes us directly, as Christians, wrestle with some very tough questions. Probably, it might be at the top of my film list right now, but Short Term 12. It breaks me every single time I watch it. And
what part gets you?
I think the first time, like, so I cry at many points in the film, but the first time I know I'm going to cry, and it's kind of like the Iron Giant, where even I don't have to see the film. If I just think about the film or certain scenes from the film, I get weepy. And that's towards the beginning of the film when she answers the phone and she says, Short Term 12, this is Grace. And it's wrecking me right now. Just because, like, that line right there is the whole movie. You know, just really good writing. So, I love your answer more than you probably know, because, you know, doing something like this, we often get people who say, you know, hey, I get what you're doing. I get that movies have meaning. I get that you can have conversations with films and you can learn a lot about yourself and culture from film, but not this one. Like, this one film is the one film that doesn't have anything to say, that there's nothing to learn about because, you know, because Michael Bay directed it, or because, you know, whatever people's objections are to it. And I'm like, that's, like, I see why you would think that, but I just don't think it's true. And I really think you can, two things. One, that you can do it with any film. And two, where I think you hit the nail on the head was that it completely depends on the person.
Yeah, totally. And it completely depends on God.
Well,
you know, that's the other thing, you know, like.
Point three that I meant to mention.
Yeah, it's only on the person, but it's on the person because, like, God is, like, interested in that person, in that individual, and like is going to meet them in a way that they can be met, you know, that they will listen. And so you just never know what it's going to be. The joke would be to say, you know, of course God could speak through a Michael Bay movie if he wanted to. Like, God spoke to Balaam through his ass. And so if there is an ass of movies, it's whatever the latest Transformers is. but that's the joke, but it's true. Like, God's going to do what God's going to do. And we cannot put any boundaries around God and what God can do, what God can use.
And I think it goes back to your hospitable kind of piece.
Yeah.
Because at one point when I first started doing this, and I would lean more heavily on film criticism than basically, you know, engaging with the film, someone would say, hey, I saw the latest Transformers movie and I thought it was amazing and I loved all these parts. And I'd be like, that film was terrible, you know, for all these reasons. And it would completely shut them down.
Right.
And I have, again, you know, obviously not perfect, but I have gotten more in the habit of not just listening to the film, but listening to the people who have listened to these films, because I think that is an incredibly hospitable thing to do. So now when someone comes and tells me that they saw, you know, the latest, whatever, a terrible movie, like, think of the worst movie you can think of that's come out this year. And the people will say that they saw that movie and I'm like, oh, really? What did you like about it? You know? And you start asking these questions, lots of the questions that you can find in your book. And I think you will learn a lot about that person and they will feel heard and listened to, and there will be a connection there, and it helps you.
Yep.
It prepares you to talk to other people about things that matter. Well, Elijah, I've really enjoyed talking to you about your book. Thanks for letting me set up these easy, out of the park, wiffle bat, whatever, home run questions for you. And I want most people who probably listen to the show have probably run across your work before, but I want you to again let people know where they can follow what you do, and most importantly, where they can buy your new book.
Sure. You can go to my website, ElijahDavidson.com, to find my latest thoughts about whatever. And then you'll find a link there to my book, How to Talk to a Movie. You can also just go to howtotalktoamovie.com, and that'll take you right to my page about my book, with directions of where you can go to buy it the easiest, and the quickest. So,
awesome. Well,
that's the best way to do it.
Well, I can't highly recommend this book enough. There's a running joke on the podcast that I don't know how to read. Every time we watch a movie about a book adaptation, I've never read the book, but I have read this. It's really good. There's so much good stuff in there. And one thing we didn't mention, that if you're someone who wanted to host movies, I get this question a lot. They say, you know, hey, I really enjoy listening to the podcast. I'd love to host a movie night or host a movie outing, either for my church or for some friends, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. How do I do that? Well, I don't have to write you an incredibly long email or Facebook post anymore. I can simply point you to this book, because, if you read this book, there is basically an outline on how to go about having these conversations, with not only the films, but with your friends. And you know, so Elijah, you've already made this roadmap, and I would just suggest people use that, because it's, like I said, it's simple, it's straightforward. And like I said, I can't overstate how well it kind of puts everyone on the same page with that vocabulary, and the ideas. So we're all, like, again, we're all speaking the same language. So
that's good. Awesome.
Well, you can, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com, and we'll have all the show notes, all the links for Elijah there. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. And hey, if you've liked this interview and want to hear us do more interviews kind of like this, let us know. Speak out, tell us what you like, what you didn't like. And mostly me, I'm sure, but we'd also like to thank everyone else who makes this show possible, for all of you guys who have listened to this first interview episode. For Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!